concern from you. But before I start, just a couple things. The restroom's on the right hand side. If you can, just put your phones and your beepers, whatever you have, medical or digital devices on the concrete, just to avoid disturbance. If you need to get out, by all means, this is a very laid back forum. Please get up, help yourself, do whatever you need to. And if you have a question, if you can, please speak into the mic because we are recording this. Why? Because we value your information, your questions. We're collecting data for future MDS patient forums and how we can make it better. We have a fabulous doctor here today to represent the hematology division of Emory, Dr. Langston, and she's going to start doing her presentation. She's going to leave ample enough time, hopefully, for questions. If you have questions that are, say, you know, we're running out of time or running on cue, we're trying to stay on time only because of, everybody needs, it's Saturday. We want to, enjoy our beautiful spring day, but if you have leftover questions, feel free to write them down and give it to Deborah Murray, who's outside. She's the registrar person from MDS. And we will try to answer those questions for you at a later time. There is one more thing. There's a questionnaire in your booklet that you may have received, which is this. And inside on the left-hand side, behind the membership form, there's a questionnaire. If you can, when you have a chance, please help us fill that out and hand it over to either myself or Deborah. Why? Because, again, we want to know what's happening to you as a patient and collect that information to know where you stand with your disease and how we as MDS Foundation can help you and the caregivers that are taking care of you. So thank you so much for coming on today, and we will start with Dr. Langston. Thank you.
Thank you. Well, it's a pleasure to be here today. It's great to see so many of you out on a nice, sunny Saturday. My name is Amelia Langston. I'm a hematologist just down the road at Emory. I actually run the transplant program, but for many years I have had a particular interest in MDS. And today I'm going to talk about current approaches to management of MDS and a little bit about new treatments that may be coming down the pipe. Before we start, just a little note to say I think this week we've all been marathoners and we've all been Bostonians, so I think we all have Boston in our hearts and minds this week, and I'm happy that they have gone. So I think it's useful to start with a little bit of historical background about MDS. It was really not until 1953 that there was the first description of a collection of a series of patients with what we now know to be MDS. At that time, they called it pre-leukemia. And what it was a group of a series of patients that presented with various iterations of low blood counts, and eventually blossomed into what we now know to be AML. It wasn't until a couple of decades later that we had the first classification system of MDS, the old French-American-British classification, later superseded by the World Health Organization's refinement of that classification. In 1997, a group of investigators interested in MDS got together and analyzed a large body of data for almost 1,000 patients with MDS and came up with the first prognostic scoring system, what we now know to be the IPSS. And that's now just recently been superseded by a revised version of that IPSS that we'll talk about in a few minutes. So in terms of treatment for MDS, it was really in the 1980s and 1990s that we had the first you know, concrete demonstration that allogeneic stem cell transplantation could be curative for myelodysplastic syndromes. Turns out, though, that for most patients, that may not be an option. So we didn't really have great options for the people that could not have a transplant. We had erythropoietin approved in 1989, but it really was not until just about 10 years ago that we had FDA approval of the first agent, azacitidine, that actually made a difference in terms of changing the natural history of the disease. We'll talk about that. And then in fairly short order, we had lenalidomide and most recently decitabine, FDA approved. And these have been, turned out to be critical breakthroughs in terms of the management of patients with MDS. And I think it's changed a lot the way that doctors think about MDS. Because if you think about it, until a decade ago, we really did not have effective treatments at all for those patients who were not eligible for transplant. So there wasn't a great degree of motivation to make the diagnosis or to really explain to patients what their treatments were, options were, because they were very limited. So look, if we start at the beginning, what is MDS? And, you know, in a technical sense, MDS is really a group of what we refer to as clonal bone marrow failure disorders, characterized by really three things. First of all, the maturation of the normal cells in the bone marrow is aberrant and disorder. That leads to ineffective hematopoiesis, that is, ineffective formation of the normal white blood cells, red blood cells, and platelets, leading to low blood counts. And then there's also a variable risk of progression to acute leukemia. I think in a more generic sense, what MDS is it's a sick bone marrow syndrome. It really is that your bone marrow is a blood factory, and really what happens with MDS is that the blood factory has become damaged, and as a consequence, it's unable to do its job as effectively as it's supposed to. Now, just to put MDS in perspective, this is not lung cancer or breast cancer. This is a relatively uncommon set of diseases in the United States. There are about 10,000 new cases a year. This is probably an underestimate because, again, many times the disease may not be diagnosed because of the age and other underlying conditions of the patient, but even if we account for that, even if we say that the incidence is really double that, it's still relatively uncommon compared with common solid cancers. An increasing proportion of cases of MDS are actually a consequence of our own successes in terms of treating other types of cancer with chemotherapy and radiation. It's estimated that probably 10 to 20% of cases are secondary to chemotherapy and radiation exposure. I think another important point to make is that the majority of patients diagnosed with MDS are diagnosed in the later decades of life, and that certainly influences the kinds of treatments that may be appropriate to consider. And the only potentially curative therapy for MDS that we have today is allogeneic stem cell transplantation. This just illustrates what I've already mentioned, and that is that the incidence of MDS increases with increasing age, but I think this graphically shows you that it increases exponentially with increasing age, so that really when we get into the 70s and 80s, the risk of MDS goes way, way up. Now, what causes MDS? MDS is really a disease of genetic wear and tear. That the genetic wear and tear may be chemotherapy or radiation or chemicals that we can identify, but most of the time it's things that we really can't identify. So we don't know whether it's the hamburgers we ate from the grill last week, you know, and last month and last year, or whether it's other things that we may not even be aware of in the environment. So for most patients, we really cannot answer the question, why do I have this? Now, the clinical presentation of MDS is really quite variable, but patients usually present with low blood counts. Anemia is not universal, but the symptoms may be very vague. It may be feeling tired, having some chest pain, it may be unusual bleeding or what we call petechiae on the skin, which is a manifestation of having low blood counts. It may be unusual infections. And another point to make is that we often make the diagnosis on analysis of just routine blood work. So many patients come in and they actually don't even have symptoms, particularly people who are younger. So there isn't really one danger signal that says, oh my God, I should be worried about having MDS. Likewise, the differential diagnosis, that is the other diagnoses to really consider, are really quite broad. There are a number of secondary causes of abnormal blood counts, primarily relating to deficiencies in various vitamins and things. People with chronic diseases many times will have low blood counts just as a matter of the normal course of the disease. There also are some other blood diseases that we need to discriminate, the most important of which are aplastic anemia, myeloproliferative neoplasms, and an entity called LGL leukemia, which is actually a disease of the immune system. So it really requires a certain amount of expertise to make the diagnosis of MDS. And I think one of the most important points to make is that a bone marrow aspirate biopsy is essential. Someone cannot give you a diagnosis of MDS without doing a bone marrow biopsy. And this is one of the reasons why it may be that this is an underdiagnosed condition, because many times either the doctor or the patient will not wish to do this type of an invasive test unless there is a possibility of therapy that might be helpful. Now, I think another point to make is that MDS exists in kind of a continuum with a number of other diseases, aplastic anemia and acute leukemia, the myeloproliferative neoplasms, and paroxysmal nocturnal hemoglobinuria, or PNH. And there is a certain amount of overlap in terms of these diagnoses, and they can all also morph one into another, and we'll talk a little bit more about that. Now, the genetics of MDS are rather unique. About half of patients with MDS will have abnormal chromosomes examined under the microscope in the bone marrow. And there really are two categories of chromosomal abnormalities that are common. There are deletions or numerical abnormalities, and then there are translocations where different chromosomes get hooked together that aren't supposed to be connected. The translocations tend to be associated with more rapid progression to acute leukemia. And there's also, in addition to chromosomal abnormalities, there are other genetic abnormalities that may lead to changes in gene expression through changes in the methylation of genes. And that really forms the basis of one of our forms of therapy, and that I'll talk about, which is hypomethylating therapy. Now, in an individual patient, there may be a number of different physiologic factors that that work to create the MDS phenotype. I won't get into this except to say that the different factors may be different in different patients, and that forms the basis of the idea that every patient does not respond the same to an individual therapy, and that all forms of MDS are not the same. Now, in terms of naming, I show here kind of a comparison between the old French, American, British classification and the newer World Health Organization classification, but I think what's common here is the idea that as we move down the list, we go from the sort of what I'll call low-grade disease to more aggressive disease with increasing proportions of leukemic blasts. And today we define the borderline between myelodysplastic syndromes and acute leukemia, or AML, as being more than 20% blasts in the bone marrow. Now, we also have a scoring system, the IPSS, which takes into account really three elements in assigning scores. scores, the percentage of blasts in the bone marrow, the chromosomal abnormalities, if they're there, and the number of lineages in which there are abnormal blood counts, so anemia, thrombocytopenia, and leukopenia. And you get a score in each one of these categories, and then you get a, you add them up, and it gives you a total score, and that allows assignment to a particular risk category, and those risk categories correspond to the risk of leukemic progression as well as average survival. Now, we've known for a long time that this is a relatively crude system for prognosticating, and it doesn't necessarily capture all the information that we have. And in particular, it was not the old IPSS was not very good at capturing all the information that we understand about the chromosomal abnormalities. And so the IPSS has actually been superseded by a new scoring system that was published just about a year ago, the so-called revised IPSS. And the primary difference here is that they have subdivided the chromosomal abnormalities more precisely and given a, to create a more refined scoring system. And again, we now have five categories of prognostic variables: chromosomes, the percentage of bone marrow blasts, the hemoglobin, platelets, and the neutrophil count, all counted separately. And again, you get a score in each category, and we can subdivide patients into five prognostic groups. And I think this scoring system, although it's not necessarily in widespread use outside of kind of the MDS community yet, I think offers much more precise information prognostically because of the refinement of the cytogenetic scoring system. Now, when we think about new therapies or old therapies, we have to have criteria for response. And these are the response criteria that we use for MDS. And basically, what we know is that there are some therapies that may be capable of creating complete or partial remissions. Some therapies may result in hematologic improvement, but not necessarily improvement in the bone marrow. There are some therapies that are capable of creating chromosomal responses, that is, taking somebody that has abnormal chromosomes to start with and getting rid of the bad cells, and that's really a surrogate marker for wiping out the bad cells. But I think one of the most important things to consider and what really has to be incorporated into all of our research has to do with the issue of quality of life, because many of these therapies are can be quite rigorous, and so it's important that quality of life measurements be built into all of our trials, particularly when we're talking about therapies that may not be curative. Now, in the management of MDS, I really ask three critical questions. Who is the patient? What's the major problem that MDS is causing for the patient, and what are the goals of therapy? And the first question that we really have to ask is the patient an appropriate candidate for consideration of allogeneic transplantation? And if so, how are we going to do the transplant, and when is it appropriate to consider that? And I'll just present a simple but I think illustrative case of an unusual patient, a 40-year-old man who presents with low blood count. He has no past significant past medical history. He's got a bone marrow. He's got bone marrow findings that define a relatively high risk situation. He's got 15% myeloblasts in the marrow, and he's got bad risk cytogenetics. So this is a great example of a young person who doesn't have other medical illnesses, and he's got bad MDS. And it's very likely that without definitive therapy, his lifespan is going to be very limited. This is exactly the kind of patient who is kind of a no-brainer that he needs to be referred for consideration of transplantation. These are survival curves from the Center for International Bone Marrow Transplant Research, looking at outcomes for allogeneic stem cell transplantation in adults with MDS using conventional methods of preparation. And I think what this shows is really a couple of things. First of all, these survival curves show that there is the possibility to cure MDS, as illustrated by the fact that the curve flattens out after a period of time. But I think the other thing that we see here is that there's a very rapid drop-off in terms of survival associated with transplant maneuver, and that reflects the fact that transplant is our most effective anti-leukemic and anti-disease therapy, but it's also our most dangerous. And there's a significant risk of dying as a consequence of the transplant maneuver itself. What's happened in the last decade or so is that we have moved away from some of the more aggressive ways of doing transplant into a sort of what I'll call a kinder and gentler possibility for transplantation. And we now have the potential to do what we refer to generically as mini transplants. And the way a transplant works is that there is a period of time, there's a pre-transplant conditioning regimen, as we call it, that consists of some form of chemotherapy or radiation. And that pre-transplant preparation, its job is really to prepare the patient to receive the donor cells. But the other important aspect of how a transplant works is that there is a donor immune response to the abnormal cells in the body, whether it's myelodysplastic syndrome or whether it's lymphoma or leukemia. And in a mini transplant, what we do is we dial down the intensity of the pre-transplant preparation, and we ask the donor immune system to do more of the work and more of the heavy lifting. And by doing this, what it's permitted us to do is to offer transplantation to people that previously would not have been candidates for transplantation, and it allows safer transplantation really for many patients who don't necessarily require such intensive preparation. And I just show here, you know, quickly some statistics to make the point that mini transplantation is a possibility and can be curative for patients with MDS and secondary AML. There is still a price to pay, and there are still toxicities, but most of the patients transplanted in these various studies would not have been candidates for transplantation using the more conventional high-dose preparative regimens. What we have gone on to really learn is that the most important predictors of how somebody's going to do with a transplant are not necessarily age, but what we call comorbidities. That is, other medical illnesses. So give me a 70-year-old who's healthy any day over a 50-year-old who's not. And this is just the scoring system that we use in transplant to decide how healthy a person is. And it really takes into account cardiac disease, respiratory disease, and many other types of comorbidities in terms of predicting how somebody's likely to do if we offer them a transplant. And what we know is that these scores are capable of discriminating between patients that have a very low risk of having problems with the transplant all the way to patients that are actually relatively likely to have morbidity and mortality associated with the transplant. So I think in terms of observations from these early transplant studies of reduced intensity conditioning regimens, we can clearly do it. It clearly can be curative for patients that otherwise might not have been candidates for transplant. Disease relapse is more of an issue when we do the transplants with these mini transplant regimes. And so the disease has to be under control at the time of the transplant maneuver. Specifically, we need to have the blasts in the marrow reduced to a very low level before doing the transplant. We We certainly consider reduced intensity transplantation in patients up to the age of 65 and 70 if they are otherwise healthy, with the caveat that disease needs to be controlled prior to the transplant. But the fact is that the majority of patients are not with MDS are not necessarily going to want or need or be candidates for transplant. So what about everybody else besides our 40-year-old guy and so forth? And I think one of the important points to make is we need to really seriously consider what the goals of therapy are and whether the patient really needs therapy at that particular moment. Now, the core of management of MDS, at the very least, is what we refer to as supportive care, which can be transfusions, it can be antibiotics, it can be growth factors. Another question that comes up that I'll just talk about briefly is iron overload, because patients that get a lot of transfusions over a long period of time can get overloaded with iron, and that can cause long-term problems in terms of toxicity to vital organs. We have a lot of information about the importance of iron overload in childhood diseases that result in the need for lots of transfusions. We don't have as much information in the area of MDS, but what we do know is that patients who have low-risk MDS and live for a long time can very definitely get iron overloaded. So as sort of a common sense approach, I certainly seriously consider iron chelation, which is the administration of medications to leach out the iron from the organs in patients with low-risk disease who I think are requiring transfusions and are likely to live for long enough for iron to be a big issue. Now, in terms of the management of low-risk MDS, lenalidomide, or Revlimid as it's called, is one of the mainstays of our management. Lenalidomide is related to an older drug, thalidomide, that many of you may have heard of. Lenalidomide is structurally related to thalidomide, but is not teratogenic and is not neurotoxic, but it is myelosuppressive. We don't know exactly how this class of drugs works in MDS. There are probably multiple different mechanisms of action, but they clearly work both through the immune system and through direct anti-tumor effects. The studies of MDS, of lenalidomide in MDS, are primarily in patients with low-risk disease, and it was noted very, very early on in the course of the development of the drug that it had very unique activity specifically in patients who had the chromosomal abnormality 5q minus, that is deletion of the long arm of chromosome 5. And in that group of patients, as I'll show you, there's a very, very high likelihood that patients will respond to therapy. But there were parallel studies both in patients with and without 5q minus, specifically looking at patients who were red cell transfusion dependent and who had otherwise good blood counts. And I think that's an important point to make, because this is a drug that is suppressive of the bone marrow. So it causes the other blood counts to go down. And in these studies, lenalidomide was given orally, and that's the other point, is this is the one treatment that we have for MDS that's a pill. So that aspect of it is really convenient. And what they saw in these two parallel studies was that in patients with the deletion 5q, about two-thirds of patients, all of whom were red cell dependent at the start, became transfusion independent in the course of therapy with lenalidomide. And almost half of patients had disappearance of their chromosomal abnormality, and the duration of therapy was measured really in years, with some patients having very, very long-lasting remissions with 5q minus. But what was also seen was that even in patients without 5q minus, about a quarter of patients who were anemic became transfusion independent with a shorter duration of response, but certainly meaningful responses in a substantial minority of patients. So I think for patients with low-grade MDS who have otherwise good counts, lenalidomide is absolutely a reasonable treatment option to try, particularly for patients with abnormalities of 5Q. The major adverse events with lenalidomide were suppression of the other blood counts, neutropenia, and thrombocytopenia. Unlike the situation for multiple myeloma, which is the other disease situation where lenalidomide is used, and where blood clots are a big issue. Blood clots are not so much of a big issue with patients with MDS. Now, the other class of drugs that we have for MDS are the so-called hypomethylating agents, and I'm not really going to bore you with an explanation of this diagram, except to say that how these drugs work is they work on this enzyme here, DNA methyltransferase, and they alter the expression of genes. And we think that that has something to do with how these drugs work in terms of reversing gene expression abnormalities in the abnormal MDS cells. Now, the first drug to be FDA approved for MDS was 5-azacitidine, and 5-azacitidine has been studied in a large phase 3 international multi-center trial, and this study involved not low-risk MDS patients, but high-risk patients, patients who had excess blasts, patients who had bad risk of cytogenetics, patients who were well on their way to acute leukemia, and in fact, this study included some patients who we would now reclassify according to current criteria as having acute leukemia. And in this study, patients were randomized to either azacitidine or what was called conventional care. And conventional care could be supportive care, it could be low-dose chemotherapy, or it could be actually induction leukemia-like therapy, depending on the physician and patient choice. And what they saw in this study was that patients who were randomized to azacitidine actually had a longer survival than patients randomized to the alternative arm. And that difference in survival was about 5 or 6 months, and it was highly statistically significant. What was also seen in this study, which was really the first study to show a survival advantage, other than transplant studies, to show a survival advantage among patients with MDS, was that quality of life was actually as good or better in the patients who received azacitidine as the patients who received other therapies. There was a reduction in the red cell transfusion dependence in patients receiving azacitidine. There was a lengthening of time to AML or death, and there was a reduction in infections associated with the use of azacitidine in this study, all of which are really important secondary endpoints. Another point to make is that that regardless of this category of response that patients had, patients with azacitidine did better than patients in the alternative arm, whether they had a complete remission, a partial remission, or hematologic improvement. Another point to make is that azacitidine takes a long time to work, so it doesn't work in a week or even a month. And in fact, it took some patients as long as 9 cycles of therapy, and cycles were given on monthly intervals to achieve their best response. So we don't stop treating patients with azacitidine just because we don't see an immediate improvement in things. And in fact, I tell people they need to fasten their seatbelts because things are likely to get worse before they get better in terms of the blood counts. Now, decitabine is sort of a cousin of azacitidine, but very similar in terms of how we think that it works. And it has also been studied in a large randomized study compared with supportive care. This study was done differently, and that may account for the difference in results. In this study, they capped the duration of therapy at 8 cycles. And they also use a dosing schedule for decitabine that is not the dosing schedule that's most commonly used today, and probably is a less favorable dosing schedule than what we have. But what they saw was about a third of patients had responses in the decitabine arm. Again, the median time to response was about 4 months, although overall survival was slightly better in the decitabine arm, it did not achieve statistical significance. There was also a trend toward a lengthening of time to AML or death, but it was not statistically significant. I think our best explanation for why this study was a negative study, when we know that this drug works in MDS, is that they really studied the wrong schedule. And they also didn't continue the drug as they did in the azacitidine trial for as long as the patient was benefiting. A more definitive study with this drug is unlikely to be done, and I think it's also unlikely that the two drugs are going to be directly compared. There's been an attempt to run such a study, and really it was not well accepted by the medical community. So what do we know at this point about hypomethylating therapy? We certainly know that azacitidine is associated with a survival benefit in patients with advanced disease. We know that it takes a while to get there. We know that continuation of the drug is until progression is supported by data. What we know about decitabine is that with the current schedules that are commonly used today, and these are data that I'm not showing you, but the complete remission rates and partial remission rates with decitabine using what I'll call the American schedule are at least as good as with azacitidine, but we don't have survival data in that setting. There's a lot of interest in combinations with these drugs, particularly for patients once they stop responding, but it's not clear yet that there's an advantage for combination therapy. I think probably the most important thing to say is that once patients have started to lose their response to these agents, there is no standard therapy. And so every patient is a candidate for a clinical trial. Now, what else is on the horizon? And we certainly have a number of clinical trials ongoing at Emory, both in the transplant and the non-transplant arena. In the non-transplant area, we've got 3 new drugs that are in trial. With MDS, we have a phase 3 trial of this ON090 in patients who have failed hypomethylating therapy. We also have a phase 1 study that is an early phase study of TGO2 citrate in patients. It's a much broader study that includes MDS patients. And then for patients with low-risk disease, the RE614 compound is available. But we also have a number of transplant trials that are ongoing that include MDS patients. There is a trial for younger patients comparing reduced intensity with full intensity conditioning regimes prior to allo transplant for patients with MDS and AML. We've got a couple of phase 2 studies looking at different ways to prevent graft versus host disease following allogeneic transplantation. There are a number of other types of things in clinical trials around the country. There are a number of newer drugs. I think it's fair to say that we don't yet have a home run on the horizon, but there's a lot of research ongoing, looking at new targets, new agents, new ways to give agents. And so with that, I think I'm going to stop and open things up for questions. I do want to just acknowledge Robin Roberts, because I think she has probably single-handedly done more than anyone else that I know to really bring MDS out there. And also, she's done a great deal in terms of bringing bone marrow and stem cell transplantation to the forefront. And so I'll thank Robin and close with that and open things up to questions.
If I can, please, again, speak into the microphone, only because we are recording. We want to capture all your questions and comments. So I'll leave the floor to you guys. Dr. Langston's available for any questions. Anybody wants to share their story or have a question related to their treatment and if there is any other option, whatever way you want to approach it. So,
yes, Ryan. Sir.
Study being going on, continuing to go on right now by Dr. Cobo, Gainesville, Florida, Shannon University.
Okay.
And it's part of a willow tree from South Africa.
Okay.
Do you know anything about that?
I don't. I know that there certainly are a lot of compounds that are being studied right now. I'm not familiar with that one, except that I heard someone just this morning, someone else mention that, but I'm not aware of published results on that. But if you know something we don't know, please share. So one of the areas of cancer medicine that we study is what are called anti-angiogenic agents. And I think that's probably what you're referring to. There's not a lot of data in blood cancers yet to really speak to whether these agents that block blood vessel formation are going to turn out to be effective or not, specifically in MDS. There are data in some of the solid cancers that blocking blood vessel formation is a very effective way of essentially squeezing out and tumors and starving them of their nutrition. But I'm not aware of a whole lot of data about that class of agents yet in leukemias and pre-leukemias. Yes, ma'am?
Is there any evidence
That is a great question. There are a handful of inherited syndromes that are associated with myelodysplasia and AML, Fanconi's anemia, dyskeratosis congenita, and several other inherited Bloom's syndrome. Those are very, very rare inherited conditions. And the blood aspect of things is not necessarily the most ominous aspect of it. Usually those people have a lot of other problems that bring them to attention in childhood, actually. There also are a handful, and when I say a handful, I mean probably dozens worldwide, handful of families in which myelodysplasia and AML are inherited in what appears to be a dominant fashion. Those are very, very rare families. I can count on my hand the number of families like that I've seen. I'm actually working with a couple of them now, but that's really just a large referral center. So for the vast majority of people with MDS, it is not, at least as we understand it, an inherited situation. Yes.
I was going to ask on that same factor. My daughter has MDS, and her mm-hmm. dad just passed away with AML. So she has it secondary from Hodgkin's lymphoma. But what about the siblings, like her brother or sister? Should they get tested, too, if it's a possibility? They don't have any symptoms, but if...
Again, without knowing all of the details, I think that's a little bit hard to answer. But the problem is there's not a good way secondary to chemotherapy, that's a little bit different than multiple people in the same family having MDS as a primary disease. So, but certainly if you're concerned about that, that's something that you could see a genetic counselor about. But there's not, it's not like there's a genetic test that you can do to say, do I have the gene?
Is there any relationship between restless leg syndrome and MDS?
Not that I'm aware of, except to say that people who are anemic may be more likely to have muscle spasms, and there may be a higher incidence of restless leg syndrome associated just with being anemic.
We've had a situation with, so far, two bone marrow biopsies. The second one was very good, but what we were told is that that kind of represented that spot. So my question is, when there is a bone marrow biopsy done, is it representative of all the bone marrow or just that sort of spot where it was taken?
Well, that's a great question. So for some diseases, like lymphomas, for example, taking a single bone marrow biopsy may not be very representative of what's going on in the marrow. But for diseases like MDS and acute leukemia, that's not generally the case. Now, that begs the question of whether or not the bone marrow biopsy itself was technically adequate. And you can only look at what you have under the microscope, and you know, the bigger the bone marrow biopsy and the more material you have to look at, the more precise you can be about what's going on. But to say that there might be spotty involvement of the bone marrow by MDS is probably not the case. Does that make sense?
Yes, thank you.
But it may be that if you only got a very, very small amount of material, that it might be inadequate to fully elaborate on everything that's going on. Yes,
I am an MDS patient diagnosed 7 years ago with Robert.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, I thought that you could get a second opinion on it. But my question has to do with this. I play for right now or range right around fairly steady at about 20 to 30,000. And I rarely have what I'm playing with infusions. But the odd thing is that because of Robin Roberts, my wife has learned now that she may have the same symptoms as Robin. So she had breast cancer 3 years ago and received chemo and radiation. And now ever since the end of that, her platelet counts are low.
They're
around 80,000, 90,000. We learned that from Robin Roberts that chemo can cause low platelets. And 6 weeks ago, my wife had a bone marrow biopsy because she has insisted on knowing whether she has MDS or IPP or whatever you call it, and her bone marrow was fine. Is that something that we need to follow up on a regular basis, maybe over the course of a year or something, if her counts remain low? And will the counts ever go back to the normal range?
Well, it's not uncommon for people who have had chemotherapy for breast cancer or other kinds of cancers to be left with slight abnormalities in their blood counts just as a consequence of the long-term effects of the chemotherapy on the bone marrow progenitor cells themselves. And it doesn't necessarily have to, we wouldn't necessarily classify that as a myelodysplastic syndrome without other abnormalities that we talked about. Now, does she need to be followed we do need to have regular blood work, you know, at least every 6 months or a year, just as a matter of course. And I think most people who have had chemotherapy, that applies to whether they have abnormal blood counts or not, because these risks do exist. Yeah, I think that's less likely. Yes.
I have a question. I'm not sure exactly how to pronounce this, but how do you feel about a clinical trial that my father's actually trying right now at Moffitt in Tampa? Is the Sotiricept injection that's getting every 3 weeks? Have you heard of anything like that?
I don't know a lot about the results, but again, I support the idea that until we have these problems solved, we should be exploring new agents.
Can I ask you one more question too? You talked about the iron elbow, and when a patient becomes so independent of transfusions, they're getting 1 to 2 units every week. Mm-hmm. Obviously, iron is going to become an issue. I mean,
right.
All the medicines that are out there for the iron, would that actually solve that problem, or if he still continues to be that transfusion dependent, will it just keep getting worse in the iron?
So that's a good question. So iron, with iron chelation therapy, we can usually sort of, I'll call it stay even with the iron. We may not completely eliminate iron deposition, but we certainly can slow the buildup of iron. And the organs that we're most concerned about are the liver and the heart, although it can deposit in lots of different places. We can usually, I'll say, keep up with it. But you can't completely eliminate it, because if someone's really requiring blood transfusions that frequently, most people can't tolerate the chelation therapy in high enough doses without having side effects to completely get rid of all the iron.
Okay. Thank you.
The research that's going on now for new drugs, et cetera, is that, are you all looking for a cure, or are we just looking for something that will help maintain the quality of life? I mean, I hear all of the, you know, the pills and the different things that can be taken, but where is there a hope for people that cannot take bone marrow transplants? They're not qualified for that. Is there hope for them?
You know, we are always looking for a cure, other than bone marrow transplantation. I mean, certainly, I would be very, very happy if we didn't have to do bone marrow transplants anymore for myelodysplastic syndromes and for all other diseases for that matter. And I'll just use sort of a simple example to kind of illustrate how that can happen. We have the disease chronic myeloid biologic leukemia, CML, that some of you may be familiar with. And in CML, there is an abnormal chromosomal translocation called the Philadelphia chromosome. There was about 15 years ago, they developed a new drug called Gleevec, which many of you may be familiar with. Gleevec targeted specifically that chromosomal abnormality. And when they started to study it in CML, it turned out to be as close to a home run as really anything that we could have imagined, as a very, very targeted therapy for a very specific type of leukemia. Now, Gleevec does not cure CML, but it effectively makes CML into a chronic disease for most patients who have it. CML was a disease that used to be our single biggest indication for allogeneic stem cell transplantation. So more patients receive transplants for CML than any other blood cancer. We now very rarely do transplants for that disease unless the Gleevec doesn't work. So I think in answer to your question, we're always looking for a cure. But even if we don't find a cure, if we we can make the disease into something that people can live with and live well with, then we may win. Does that?
Yes, I had a transplant 2 years ago, and I was wondering if there's any statistics on it reoccurring, or do you have any kind of records on that?
Well, we do. And I'm happy to talk with you about your individual case afterwards, but the risk of relapse after a transplant, because a transplant is certainly not a guarantee in terms of control of this disease, but the risk of relapse really depends upon the details of the transplant, but also it depends on the state of affairs of your bone marrow at the time that you go into the transplant. So the fewer the blasts in the marrow, the less likely the disease is to come back. The more intensive the chemotherapy that was given before the transplant, the less likely the disease is to come back. And the greater the percentage of donor cells that are present in the marrow and in the blood, the less likely the disease is to come back. So all of those factors figure into answering that question for you. And I'm happy to speak with you about it after, but it's not a generic answer to that question. Yes, ma'am.
So if you have a patient in your later 50s with a history of heart disease with the variation RAEV and possibility of lung cancer, what is our best treatment option to go forward? Because they said we can't really treat the MDS until we address the lung cancer if it comes back to be lung cancer.
So again, I think that is sort of an individual question, and without knowing all the details about that particular case, it sounds to me like the lung cancer question probably needs to be clarified as far as is it or isn't it before addressing the MDS. But yes, sir.
Are there any treatments for myelofibrosis now?
That's a great question, and yes, there actually are quite a number of new drugs that are either in development or that have one that's been FDA approved. And the basis for that is that in the myeloproliferative disorders, which are kind of, kissing cousins to MDS, it's been discovered that there's a molecule called JAK2, which is mutated in a substantial proportion of people with myeloproliferative neoplasms. And so there's a series of drugs that have been developed that inhibit this molecule, JAK2. And one of those drugs has actually made it to the clinic now and has a significant impact in terms of reducing spleen size as well as making people feel better. It doesn't improve the blood counts. It does not cure the disease. And it may not arrest the natural history of the disease, but it certainly allows people to have a better quality of life with myelofibrosis. Other drugs that are being looked at, Furod is under active treatment for myelofibrosis. Lenalidomide is being studied in myelofibrosis, and the hypomethylating agents, the decitabine and azacitidine that I talked about, are also being studied and used in myelofibrosis as well. So I think there are a lot more treatment options for MF than there were a few years ago. And transplant is also a consideration for patients with myelofibrosis.
I have a question about starting treatment. My husband, his blood count is low and the cells are in irregular shape. But, so far we do nothing. We just go back for blood to watch the blood count. Is there like a magic number that we say, okay, doctor, do a bone marrow biopsy and let's start treatment?
Well, I think that's an important question, an important issue. Sometimes people have MDS, particularly particularly low-grade MDS, and they may not be having a problem. You know, the blood counts are abnormal, so it bothers the doctor, but it's not really bothering the patient. And in those instances where there aren't chromosomal abnormalities to suggest that the disease is imminently going to progress to something else, and if the blood counts are not terribly abnormal, then there may not be an indication to do anything other than closely observe, because the treatment may produce problems that are worse than the disease. But is there a magic number? There really is not. The way that I look at it is at the point where something bad is about to happen, or I believe something bad is about to happen based on the blood work, or at the point where we're about to need to intervene with transfusions of some sort, or at the point where the person is having a symptom, then that's usually my trigger point to really start to have a dialogue about treatment.
Okay, so it's not like an infection and you want to get to it right away.
No, there's no evidence that getting to it right away, or an early stage breast cancer or something like that, where, well, we can just get it right now and nip it in the bud. And in fact, it may be the other way around, because our treatments are limited, we may want to hold some things in our pocket so that we don't spend it all at a time when the person really isn't having a problem.
As someone who is young and is dealing with MDS, what point, and it's well controlled and I've had chemotherapy, what point would you suggest, and I know that you can't really say too much without going into great detail about my particular case, but do you offer a transplant when everything's good and going steady, or do you wait till it progresses to a high risk category or progresses to a point to where it doesn't respond, then go, now is the time to do transplant, or is it better to do it early on when you're relatively healthy in that sense?
So I think this is an important question, and you know, particularly for someone like you who's young and healthy. And again, without giving you individual medical advice, I think that for a person who is young and healthy, who has myelodysplastic syndrome that is confirmed and then is secondary to chemotherapy, it probably makes sense to have your transplant options very well fleshed out, for sure. In other words, who would be the donor, and you know, where does that fall in terms of the risk of the transplant maneuver? And that may guide the decision about what triggers going forward with the transplant. So if you had a brother or sister or a very well-matched, unrelated donor available, then that's a maneuver that is a relatively good risk maneuver and something that I would consider doing sooner rather than later. Whereas if the transplant option is not such a good donor, not such a good match, then that would argue for dragging our feet as long as we can. But there's no question that the outcomes of transplant are better when it is done earlier in the course of the disease and at a time when the person has not been beaten up by other kinds of treatments.
Thank you.
Yes, ma'am.
Most of the time we're able to deal with the low blood counts that Revlimid induces
like dropping the dose or changing the schedule. Sometimes some people take it every other day, or they may take a smaller dose, or they may take it on a different schedule. So one would hope that with dropping the dose, the blood count will come up. But
one more question. This is just something like you asked for a moment. Genetic and hereditary descent, one of the same thing.
So, great question. Is genetic and hereditary the same thing? So, when we talk about genetic changes in a generic way, what we're talking about is changes in the DNA. Okay? We all have DNA, we all have genetic mutations in our DNA. But most of those genetic changes are not inherited. Okay? And most of the time, the genetic changes that occur in MDS are not inherited. Okay, so they're really not the same thing. Yes, sir.
As you probably know, a lot of oncologists are not willing to play around with dosage schedules. They tend to stay on schedules that they're used to and that they feel comfortable with. We're on the methyltransferase inhibitor, decitabine. And is there anything our red cell line and our platelet line has stabilized a long time ago and has been stable for 2 or 3 years. It's the white cell line that is, bounces. And, you were talking about the original trial for decitabine and how the dosage that they used in that trial was maybe not the best dosage. Well, we're kind of wondering, one of the side effects of decitabine, of course, is myelosuppression. So is this one of the reasons why we're getting about some? We'll go from 700 ANC to 1800 ANC. And would there be a problem in, instead of going on a 3-week schedule, maybe going on a 4 or 5 week schedule at times, and see if the myelosuppression is coming from the Dacogen? Or whether our own immune system is responsible for this. I'll let you answer that. I have another question I wanted to ask as well.
Well, that's a hard one. And I would ask a question back to you. If we didn't tell you that your ANC was bouncing around, would you know? Are you having infections? Are you having a problem? Because...
Well, I always figure it up when we do the CBC and the flow cytometry as they do, each time she goes in there. And that leads to my next question. She's taking 34 milligrams of decitabine. And, I noticed in your trial there they used, 15?
15 milligrams per meter squared.
Right, yeah.
Yeah,
we're on 34 for five days a week.
5 days.
Yeah.
That's what everyone does.
Yeah.
That's really what everyone does in the United States today.
Yeah, we're 4 years out, and we feel
what
like we're doing.
The way I would answer that is the only reason, with the kind of numbers that you're giving me, the only reason I would have for changing the dosage or the schedule would be if there was a clinical problem. If we're just looking at numbers, I'm not so concerned about it, but I am impressed that she's had a response for a long time. And I wouldn't necessarily want to mess with that.
And I think that's the way our oncologist is thinking.
If there's a problem, I'm not going to respond to a number, but if there's a problem, you're having frequent infections during those times when the white count and the ANC are low, that's a different matter. And then you have to look at the question of whether you want to do dose reductions. In general, we try not to spread things out too much. I occasionally will, give people a 5 or 6 week hiatus so that they can, you know, go on a trip or do one thing or another.
Right, yeah.
So